I teach several courses out at Brook Hill. You see them up there on the screen. And a couple of years ago, we began realizing that while our students had a pretty good foundation in basic Christian values and beliefs, when they got to college, there were a lot of issues that were confronting them that they tended to struggle with. The professors were very expert in those issues, and our students were not. And so last year, we started a course called Practical Politics. And what we do in that course is take these hot-button issues, and we debate them from both angles. We discover what the Christian perspective on those issues are, and then we come up with what we call a position paper with the arguments for, against, Christian responses. They compile a notebook of all this material and take it to college with them. And we've already heard from three of our students so far this fall who have carried their notebooks to class and actually have used that. When a professor brings up something, they'll go, "Excuse me, professor," and they'll have their answers there and their arguments. So I think it's working. Three issues that we're going to talk about tonight, God willing, are critical race theory, socialism, and abortion. I usually take about a week and a half for each one of those issues. So if you've done the math, that's about 20 minutes for each one of those issues. So it's going to be like a fire hydrant tonight. One thing I'm going to do is I have my email address on the last, very last slide. And if you're interested in getting a copy of these slides or whatever, email me and I'll be happy to send those to you. And I think they're going to be on the South Spring website as well. So don't feel like you have to write down everything. So there's a lot of information. We're going to move quickly. So let's begin with critical race theory. If I can get this to work. There we go. So, what is critical race theory? We use three sources. I would recommend these books. One is Black Eye for America by Dr. Carol Swain and Christopher Shore, Christianity and Wokeness by Owen Strawn, and Fault Lines by Vadi Balcom. Those are three excellent books if you really want to dig into these subjects. So, what is it? Critical race theory is fundamentally a racist worldview predicated on the claim that racism is in the DNA of every American, all of our institutions, our society, especially white individuals. White people are oppressors by definition, along with Christianity and Western civilization. It sees minorities, especially black Americans, as victims of systemic racism. Created by whites, these institutions, to give themselves unearned advantages. Minorities, they're considered oppressed. They're helpless victims in need of liberation. And this theory is included in the broader woke definition. You've probably heard of that term before, being woke. That simply means being awake to the true nature of the world according to progressive thought, including that of critical race theory. So let's start at the beginning. It's fundamentally a Marxist ideology, but it substitutes social groups, whites and blacks, for instance, for the original Marxist economic groups, the bourgeois and the proletariat. It originated with Karl Marx, further developed by Italian communist Antonio Gramsci, who advocated weaponizing society's institutions against society itself. So to critique the counterculture's assault on gender, as we're seeing today, sexuality, marriage, family, is bigotry. So if you critique this or question it or put forth another view, you're considered a bigot. To defend Christianity, to defend traditional family, sexual norms, the rule of law is oppression and domination. So how did this philosophy get to America? Well, by a group of people known as the Frankfurt School, a group of Freudian and Marxist academics who left Germany prior to World War II in the 1930s. And these people call their approach critical theory, broad term. It simply begins with a normative vision, or a vision that they've deemed best, whatever that is, for society, describing how the item being critiqued fails that vision, usually in an institutional or systemic sense. And it prescribes activism then to subvert, dismantle, disrupt, overthrow, or change it, to break society and then remake it in accordance with whatever their prescribed vision is. Then in the 1950s, Herbert Marcuse advocated targeting marriage and family in Christianity as well, by embracing sexual revolution and gay rights. Alternative sources of support for revolutionary change would be women and racial and sexual minorities. His argument for restricting conservative speech laid the foundation for what we're seeing today, political correctness and censorship. And then, of course, postmodernism would make a key contribution to critical race theory, beginning in the late 60s, saying that there's no objective reality, there's no reasoning, knowledge, or logic. These are simply components of an oppressive and male-dominated Western ideology constructed by society. Attempts to explain history or other aspects are false and merely impose conformity on other people. The most vocal proponent today is Dr. Ibram Kendi, who said this: "The only remedy to racist discrimination is anti-racist discrimination. The only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. The only remedy to present discrimination is future discrimination." And he also said this: "The most threatening racist movement is not the alt-right's unlikely drive for a white ethno-state, but the regular American's drive for a race-neutral one." So let me repeat that. Think what he's saying here. The most threatening racist movement today in our country is the average American's drive for a race-neutral society. And of course, this is in direct contradiction to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s statement that we know by heart, probably, that people should be judged by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin. Proponents of CRT reject that. So you say, wait a minute, what if I want societal harmony between the races? That's a good thing, right? What if I admit past failures regarding race relations? That's a good thing. What if I even adopt children from other regions, or maybe in an interracial marriage? What if I try to build bonds with people different from me? What if I enjoy global culture with other people from around the world? What if I seek greater diversity in my church? What if I want greater justice in the world? Wouldn't that be considered non-racist? You would think, but not according to CRT proponents. Not at all. Under critical race theory and this system of wokeness, there are two groups, as I mentioned, only two: the oppressor and the oppressed. There's no grace, there's no forgiveness, no unity, no love. There's only grievance, resentment, and envy by the oppressed, and perpetual condemnation of the oppressor. There's no way out for the oppressor, only acknowledgement of it, ongoing shame because of it, and undertaking certain works to oppose one's nature as an oppressor, such as making financial reparations possibly, and ongoing submission to the oppressed, which is kind of interesting because now the oppressed have become the oppressors. But they don't address that for some reason. You may have heard of the term intersectionality. It's kind of a nebulous thing out there that a lot of people don't understand. Well, this is a kind of a side theory asserting that overlapping sources of oppression compound one another, rendering racial and ethnic minorities, gays, lesbians, economically disadvantaged groups, even more marginalized and victimized by society in proportion to the number of these marginalized cards they hold. So I think the best way to look at this is try to look at this chart here. If you begin with that inner circle, you see the categories on the very outward edge: gender, citizenship, skin color, formal education, etc. Look at that inner circle. If you possess any or some or all even of those inner circle characteristics, such as you're a citizen, maybe you're white, you have post-secondary education, you're able-bodied, you're heterosexual, you're slim, you own property, maybe you're wealthy, you speak English, you have no relevance. You have no legitimacy, no influence, no real right to speak in the marketplace. And the further you move out, the greater weight, the greater influence, value you have in society, in the marketplace. And so looking at that outer ring, let's say you are dark skin colored, you only have an elementary education, or maybe no education, maybe you have a disability, maybe you're gay, maybe you're a large person physically, Maybe you are homeless, poor, whatever. All of those, the more you have of those characteristics, the more legitimacy, value, influence, and right to speak. It's a mind-boggling thing to those of us that value traditional, conservative, biblical, Judeo-Christian values. So what does this have to do with us? By the way, it's categories that matter, not character. So keep that in mind. Critical race theory, it's whatever category you're in that matters. Your character has no relevance whatsoever. So here's what it has to do with us. CRT is being taught in schools and colleges as accepted fact. It's also being promoted in many corporations, businesses, the media, entertainment as accepted fact. White children are taught to be ashamed of their skin color on the grounds that they unjustly benefit from a white supremacist system established by their ancestors to keep minorities in a lower rung on the ladder. Being born into the white race automatically makes you blood guilty, a white supremacist. Think about that. Being born into a white family automatically makes you a racist, a white supremacist. I can't imagine a three-month-old child being a white supremacist, but according to CRT proponents, that's what they are. Just as bad, black children are taught that they are victims of a thoroughly and permanently racist system. Americans of all races are taught that they live in an evil nation that has wreaked great harm on the world. But in reality, as you know, civil rights laws of the latter 20th century ended any state-sanctioned racism. And the racism that remained was individual racism, and we've even made great strides there. Look at this statistic. In 1958, 4% of Americans approved of interracial marriage. But by 2013, 87% approved. CRT creates a sense of hopelessness while eroding decades of progress and goodwill. In place of equal opportunity, CRT demands equity, equal outcomes by groups. To this end, CRT demands discrimination in favor of some groups and against others. Some even demand more than equity, those permanent advantages such as reparations. And if you don't agree with the propositions of CRT, then you are a bigot. You are racist yourself. Concepts such as colorblindness, assimilation, judging based on the content of character are dismissed as cynical means by which whites maintain their power and privilege. I found this interesting. To illustrate how far this has permeated our society, consider an article published in Psychology Today entitled, Colorblind Ideology is a Form of Racism. It describes colorblindness, here's the definition, as an ideology that posits the best way to end discrimination is by treating individuals as equally as possible without regard to race or culture or ethnicity. I think that's what most of us in here would want. But Psychology Today says ignoring skin color is racist. CRT claims that only white people can be racist. Why? Because they're the dominant group, and they possess what they call the institutional power to link prejudice to meaningful action to do racist things. People of color have no ability to do that, therefore they can't be racist. CRT scholars go so far as to assert that it's impossible for white people to engage with people of color in good faith. Can you imagine? Recently, core CRT claims regarding alleged oppression in American society provided much of the impetus for the worst riots in half a century. We remember these from a couple of years ago. Violence committed by CRT-friendly groups like BLM, Antifa, were excused. Little or no consequences whatsoever, even supported, as we know, by most media. Our current vice president even established a fund for bail money to get people out of jail that were arrested during these riots. Major corporations fell in line, celebrities. So, as we know, CRT themes now pervade society and school curriculums, diversity training in the workplace, college safe spaces, segregated dorms, segregated graduation ceremonies, media and corporate advertising, entertainment, government and politics, foreign policy. Even a recent publication by the Smithsonian Institution lists the following harmful aspects of whiteness that everyone should reject: individualism, self-reliance, two-parent homes, objective, rational, linear thinking, causality, math, belief that hard work pays off, property rights, planning for the future, delaying gratification, and being polite. All of those things our government has listed as harmful. All of these are considered to be the white way of doing things and should not be adopted by people of color. It's astounding to me. And we didn't even mention this. I can't begin to imagine how a biracial individual deals with this. Can you imagine? One side, I'm an oppressor, or am I oppressed? And think of those in biracial families. How do they deal with that? It's an evil, evil ideology that can never work out. Why is it ungodly? Well, let's look at this. It tweaks the doctrine of humanity, losing sight of the imago Dei as our constituent identity. We are image bearers of God, and though sinful to the core, every human bears this identity, the image of God. We are not fundamentally disunited, but united by our common theistic formation. There are distinct ethnicities, as we know, and people groups recognized in the Bible, but this doesn't cancel our shared anthropology. We are unified, but distinctly and wonderfully made. We are one human race, our identity grounded in being made in God's image, but beautifully and diverse from this essential starting point. Wokeness, CRT, denies all of this. It emphasizes not human oneness, but human diversity, and diversity without any meaningful hope of unity. The human race was not made to hate one another, but rather to come together in Christ. Number two, another reason why it's ungodly. CRT and wokeness unhelpfully groups people according to whiteness. That's a deeply problematic concept. There's no biblical word that indicates that whiteness is wicked. There it goes. While white supremacy is wicked, as we all know and would agree, not all white people embraced such a view or practiced racism. Whiteness itself is not indicative of white supremacy. There's no biblical grounds for such a view, and to convict everyone of such wrongdoing is wrong and unbiblical. Doing so is bearing false witness or false accusation against a fellow image bearer of God. There's no such thing as whiteness. People who have a white skin are not the same. And you see the statistics there. White people are all over the place, politically and otherwise. There's no such thing as blackness. Race is not grounded in reality. I think Chris addressed this several months ago here at South Spring. While people do have common skin color, backgrounds, interests, we must never think in terms of racial patterns. Again, there's no biblical basis for the category of race. We shouldn't stereotype people. We should avoid demonizing any one group simply because of their skin color. We should treat individuals as individuals. Third reason, CRT and wokeness actually foments the very sin it presumes to critique, racism. According to CRT theology, the solution to the problem of racial prejudice is prejudice, just a different kind. Remember what Kendi said, the only remedy to racist discrimination is anti-racist discrimination. You can never overcome this condition. You can only manage it by being less white, whatever that means. Showing favoritism, even to a suffering group, is repeatedly denounced throughout Scripture. We know that because it contradicts the very character of God. But wokesters have become what they set out to oppose. In striving to defeat racism, which we all would agree is an honorable goal, they unwittingly end up disliking and judging people of a certain skin color. It promises justice, but begets injustice. If you have heard that you are guilty of white supremacy simply because of your whiteness, you have been falsely convicted and unbiblically indicted. One's skin color and heritage are not sinful. Fourth reason, CRT and wokeness treats people as oppressors and oppressed due to skin color and power dynamics. We've already talked about this. Marxists first used the pairing of rich and poor, reading the former as evil and the latter as innocent. Today, these same identifiers apply along the lines of skin color. Number five, CRT and wokeness traps us in a cycle of anger and victimhood. Though wokeness promises compassion, it never delivers. The stamp of guilt on white people as racist means that wokeness produces all sorts of anger, rage, resentment, and hostility. It doesn't create peace, it creates division. It doesn't embrace Christianity or the gospel, it embraces grievance and anger and hostility. It encourages people to embrace their victimhood. Scripture never encourages us to think of ourselves as victims, but rather as fully complicit in Adam's rebellion and deserving of eternal judgment. We're not called to a life of grievance, victimhood, and anger, but are instead freed from such a life by faith in Christ. Wokeness gives approval to evil, both in the public square and in rejecting God's design for the sexes. I think this pretty well speaks for itself. For example, Black Lives Matter openly state they seek to, quote, disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family, dismantle cisgender privilege, and uplift black trans folk, foster a queer-affirming network, and free ourselves from the tight grip of heteronormative thinking, unquote. That was on their website. I think they have since removed it from their website. Finally, CRT and wokeness overturns the gospel's no condemnation in Christ promise. The key evil that CRT addresses is the problem of whiteness and white supremacy. But racism is not an attitude of the heart, but a permanent element of whiteness, according to this view. This creates a big problem with the gospel in that whiteness cannot be overcome. In woke Christian thought, the gospel can give us new birth, but it doesn't overcome and defeat the condition of whiteness, which is viewed as inherently and permanently evil. This is where we see wokeness in CRT at its absolute deadliest. There is a condition that the gospel faith does not, cannot make right. Only anti-racism, a regimen of ritual confession and penance on the individual side and political improvement in public policy on the communal side, makes our racist wrongs right. CRT adds to the gospel and that more must be done for white people than the gospel does. There's more than just believe and repent. CRT also subtracts from the gospel. It takes away the transforming power of the blood of Christ. We must go further and engage anti-racism to overcome our condition as an oppressor. The gospel announces forgiveness and resulting innocence. CRT announces guilt and unending condemnation. CRT is a direct attack on the gospel. The result is really an anti-gospel. So how should we respond to CRT? Understand what it is, where it came from, how it contradicts Christianity, and simple reason, how to combat its influence. This is our goal with our students. We should challenge it under the law. Don't hesitate to use the legal system if you or your child's rights have been violated. Paul wasn't hesitant to use the legal system to protect his status as a Roman citizen. Build grassroots resistance movements. Mobilize, take action, the school board elections. Build broad coalitions, organize, speak out in public forums, contact public officials, pressure candidates. Get the word out, inform others through letters to the editor, social media, etc. Engage churches. Make sure they understand the insidious nature of this godless and evil theology. Confront woke institutions. Use your voice. Maybe you need to exit the institution if it's become saturated with this ideology. Stand up to big tech. Monitor your local and state agencies to ensure that you as a taxpayer are not subsidizing this type of thinking. Develop alternatives to DEI training programs in the workplace. What about the legality of it? Well, there's a lot of questions here. Being forced to embrace this ideology in schools or at work or in the marketplace, sometimes face scolding and retribution on your part. But compelling speech violates the free speech protections under the First Amendment. Punishing employees and students for noncompliance violates the 14th Amendment due process protections. singling out racial or other groups for hostile treatment seems to violate the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin, and under Title VI and IX of the 1972 Educational Amendments. Disciplining or terminating an employee for criticizing or refusing to participate in diversity, equity, and inclusion training also appears to violate anti-retaliation provisions of civil rights laws. So it seems like we have laws on the books that could be accessed to protect against some of this stuff, and do not be hesitant to look into those if necessary. And finally, CRT is a new religion with a requirement that all are forced to embrace its tenets of transgression and innocence, but without the tenets of forgiveness, charity, or humility. The church should be leading the fight against CRT. All critical theories are at odds with the biblical message of Jesus and his finished work on the cross. So that is a brief flyover of CRT. So let's jump into socialism. Sorry I'm going so fast, but we need to move along. So socialism, communism, sometimes those words are used interchangeably, but really they are different. Look at some similarities. Both are essentially economic philosophies, advocating public rather than private ownership, especially of the means of production, distribution, and exchange of goods. Both aim to fix the problems they see as created by our free market capitalistic system, including the perceived exploitation of workers. Both socialism and communism embrace equality of results rather than equality of opportunity. Those are two very important terms that I'd like for us to take just a second and explore. Equality of results is the belief that everyone should receive basically the same thing regardless of their effort. So work 40 hours a week, someone else works 20 hours a week, everyone should get about the same thing. And of course that would be government that would determine what they get and how they receive it. Equality of opportunity, on the other hand, makes sure everyone has an equal opportunity to succeed and pursue what they want to do. So under equality of opportunity, if I wanted to go try out for the Dallas Cowboys, I could do it. I could drive to Dallas, knock on their door, and go in and say, I want to apply for quarterback. And do you think they'd take me? Well, they might, considering the recent history, but they probably wouldn't. But that's not because of society. It's not because of their organization. It's because of my lack of physical ability and my age, among other things. So that's equality of opportunity. Everyone can pursue whatever they want to do in society. Equality of results, you get the same thing regardless of your effort. And of course, that's not going to work, because those that do put forth effort are going to soon realize they're going to get the same stuff whether they work hard or not. And so you can see where that goes. Are there differences? Yes, there are. Socialism, you can still own property, but industrial production, or the chief means of generating wealth, is communally owned and or managed by a democratically elected government. Socialism is less rigid, it's more flexible. Its adherents seek change and reform, but usually through the democratic processes, not through force. Unlike in communism, a socialistic economic system still rewards individual effort and innovation. Social democracy, the most common form, focuses on achieving social reforms and redistribution of wealth through democratic processes, primarily taxation. And it can coexist alongside a free market capitalistic economy. But look at communism. Under pure communism, there's no such thing as private property. All property is communally owned, controlled. Each person receives a portion based on what they need or what the government perceives they need. A strong central government controls all aspects of economic production, provides citizens with their basic necessities, including food, housing, medical care, and education. In communism, a violent revolution in which the workers rise up against the middle and upper classes is seen as an inevitable part of achieving that pure communistic state. Of course, a dark past in both those ideologies. Karl Marx called for the abolition of private property and state ownership of means of production. Lenin put the Soviet Union in charge of every aspect of life for the good of the people. Stalin, as you know, mass murdered his opposition by the tens of millions in the 20th century, declared it to be the workers' paradise. Not sure how that goes together. Hitler, of course, planned the German economy, even named his organization the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Hugo Chavez of Venezuela expropriated, nationalized, and redistributed wealth, but within two decades, it's a horrifying place with a mass exodus of refugees, as we know. But today's progressives say, well, that's not what we mean by socialism. That it wasn't done right back then. Well, many socialists say what we need is democratic socialism. If it's voted in, then it's okay. Well, no, it's not okay. It was voted in during the 1930s in Germany. We've had racist laws in many parts of the world. Those have been voted in. Just because something is approved by the population, by the citizens, the majority, just because something is legal doesn't make it good or moral. I like this cartoon. Speaks to what we just said. Well, what about Scandinavia? Socialists tend to say, well, look at Norway and Sweden and Denmark. It's perfect. You know, they have a socialist economy, a socialist state. It's working great. Well, they're really not. These countries do not have a minimum wage. They have a favorable business climate, school choice, trade-based, globalized economies, very few nationalized industries. In fact, Denmark ranks number 8 in the world in characteristics of capitalism. That's ahead of our country. So to say Scandinavia is a socialist utopia is a misstatement. So this is a very important understanding right here. To achieve socialism on a broad scale, it requires government force. Think about this. If it were widely beneficial, you wouldn't need force to create it or sustain it. If it was really so good, people would be clamoring for it. It's socialism if it concentrates power in government so that the means of production are under either the ownership or direction of the government. And or it concentrates power in government so that large swaths of the economy are planned not by market forces or entrepreneurial initiative or consumer decisions or profit and loss, but rather by government officials. And or it's socialism if it concentrates power in government for purposes of leveling incomes, redistributing wealth, and creating a welfare state. So how do you level incomes and redistribute wealth? Through taxation. Concentrating power in government to achieve any of the above requires force. A lot of people say, who are advocating socialism, that Jesus was a socialist. And they have their arguments for that. Lawrence Reed wrote this book a few years back called Was Jesus a Socialist? It's required reading in our class, and it's a great short read. You can read it in probably 2 hours. But a great read. Was Jesus a socialist? So let's look at it. Was he? Since the decision to follow Jesus is a personal, voluntary one, how could this same champion of free choice endorse the use of force to reduce free choice? To take things from some and give to others, or to plan the economy of other people, or to seize the means of production, or even to compel people to share their possessions. All of those things limit freedom of choice. Jesus never tried to obtain anybody's support by promising something he would first take from somebody else. Acts 2, 44 through 47 is the basis for this claim that Jesus was a socialist. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes. They ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. That's the basis for those who claim Jesus was a socialist. But let's look at this a little further. If these believers had everything in common, then how could they also possess their homes? Were homes an exception? Or was everything an exaggeration? Even if socialism is nothing more than sharing possessions in common, it was in this case voluntary. Nothing here at all suggests it was mandatory for all Christians and for all time, let alone for non-Christians. 2 Corinthians, it says God loves a cheerful giver. Private property rights were apparently still in effect at this time. You can't give unless you have something, right? As the number of believers grew, this practice of selling goods and holding them in common died out. And throughout history, for every Christian who participated in this type of communal existence, there were millions who didn't. As most of you know, the pilgrims at Plymouth Colony tried something similar to what Acts describes, but it almost wiped out the whole colony before they changed gears and went to the free market economy. Another attempt was made in New Harmony, Indiana. It failed after only 2 years. So nothing in the New Testament even hints that Jesus would support what today's socialists are calling for, magnifying the powers of earthly governments to redistribute wealth or impose a welfare state or centrally plan the economy or control the means of production. But we need to remember, neither is it valid to argue Jesus was a capitalist or a Republican or a Democrat. These are modern day terms. He would not identify with any of those, I don't think. Jesus offered no blueprint for earthly government. His concern focused elsewhere, namely on the sort of self-government that men and women would exercise if they followed God's law, ultimately being loyal to God's kingdom. Three parables let's look at pretty quickly. There's about 40 parables in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Only three deal with economics. And a socialist might try to find some sympathy from Jesus in these economic parables, if you want to call them that, but they're not going to find it. So the parable of the workers in the vineyard, you know the story. A private individual owns land. He hires workers of his choice who willingly accept his offer to work, terms of work that involve a wide disparity in wages, an implicit assumption that work is good, idleness is bad, supply and demand. The employer had to pay more as workers become scarce. Claims of unfairness and inequality when the workers find they're not being paid the same amount or a fair amount though each agreed to work for their respective wage. And an assertion of the rights of private property and contract. All of those are present in this story. Everything in this story is market-based. Everything is voluntary. There's no government involvement, no exploitation, no socialism. Then the parable of the talents. A man entrusts three servants with his money while he's away on a trip. One received 5 bags of gold, invested it, gained 5 more. One 2 bags, invested it, gained 2 more. One 1 bag, dug a hole and hid it. The owner returns. He was pleased with the first 2, put them in charge of even more. To the third, the owner was angry, took away the 1 bag and gave it to the one who now had 10. The one who did nothing received a reprimand, while the ones who invested and generated returns earned applause and rewards. I think this parable clearly affirms important capitalistic characteristics such as contract, profit, private property. And then finally, the parable of the Good Samaritan. A man was traveling. He was attacked, beaten by robbers. A priest and a Levite ignored him and kept on going, but a Samaritan helped him, took him to an inn to recover, paid his expenses. Jesus then asked the expert in the law which of the three was a neighbor to the victim. Of course, the one who helped the injured man out wasn't the priest or Levite, but the individual who voluntarily helped the victim with his own money. How could this be anything but an endorsement of private initiative and a generous, helpful spirit? The Good Samaritan didn't say to the victim, write a letter to the emperor, or see your social worker, or place the responsibility on someone else to take care of this injured man. While Jesus did frequently encourage people to help each other, he never suggested that this be done through third party or government coercion. It was always personal and voluntary. You know, you can certainly be a socialist and also be a Christian, but a Christian can also be mistaken about a lot of earthly political and economic matters. If a person is looking in the parables of Jesus for evidence that he was a socialist, they're not going to find it. And you know, the election coming up in about 3 weeks, really, it's about socialism. You have candidates that fully want large government, more control, more coercion, high taxes to redistribute. Another side wants smaller government. So this socialism issue is basically what we're looking at in the coming election. That's why we need to be aware of all it entails. I'm going to skip through some of these slides real quickly in the interest of time. I like Churchill's quote, "Socialism is the philosophy of failure, the creed of ignorance, and the gospel of envy." Of course, envy is just simply the desire to take something that isn't yours or to acquire something that isn't yours. So really, when you think about it, this makes socialists some of the world's greediest people, because that's their whole premise, is to take from those that have for themselves, and then according to whomever they want to give it to, they will do so. What you will find in the Bible are many expressions of gratitude, not envy, not greed. As we mentioned last week, conservatives tend to begin with gratitude for what is good and what works in our society and then strive to build on it. In other words, an optimist. Progressives or leftists, by contrast, tend to begin with outrage at what is bad and broken and seek to uproot it. Pessimists. Did the wealth that someone earned or created make someone else poorer? Of course not. The person who is wealthy creates jobs, pays large amounts in taxes, provides for charitable purposes. But according to many politicians and activists, we're not supposed to be grateful for the good that those of wealth did. Rather, we should be angry that they didn't give us more of their stuff. That sounds like envy. What about the phrase, "render unto Caesar"? Let's look at this for a second. Government is the only entity in society that possesses a legal monopoly over the use of force. When government keeps the peace and punishes harm-doers, as they should, when government adjudicates disputes through a fair and honest judicial system and treats people equally before its laws, it encourages civil society and commerce. It performs a positive good. But the governments that micromanage the lives and economy of peaceful people have much different experience, yielding corruption, violence, tyranny, and poverty. The more force government uses against people, the more it subordinates the choices of the ruled to the whims of the rulers, and the more socialist it becomes. Remember, socialism is not voluntary sharing, it's force. In a non-socialist market-based society, you are free to help people, and more help actually happens, according to statistics. Jesus said, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's." Notice that everything depends on just what truly did belong to Caesar and what didn't. That distinction amounts to a powerful endorsement of private property rights. To say certain things are anyone's assumes ownership. The reference is also to a particular individual as opposed to some nebulous collective of people. Jesus didn't say it belongs to Caesar if Caesar simply says it does. What Jesus said spoke to the rightful ownership of property. And of course, as we know, the 8th commandment says, "Thou shalt not steal." 10th commandment says, "You shall not covet." It's a leap for anyone to claim that to uphold the law meant that Jesus offered unqualified acceptance of whatever earthly government commanded. The Bible is full of stories about people who bravely resisted the overreach of government, such as the Hebrews defying Pharaoh's decrees to murder their infants, Rahab lying to the king, Daniel and others refusing to comply with the king's decrees, and so on. If they had not done so, if they had not disobeyed Herod's order to kill all infants, Jesus would have been killed weeks after his birth. I'm going to skip through Karl Marx here. You can read that later. And the Golden Rule. If you're confronting a socialist, you might begin with this conversation. Why do you want to handle so many issues and problems by force? Why must everything require government? Where's your faith in and respect for your fellow citizen? You're so certain that forcing others to bend to your will is a good thing. Would you mind if we maybe turn the tables and do the same to you? If not, then why do you get to do those things, but we don't? Be interesting to see a response there. I'm going to skip through this a little bit. I like the last point on this slide here. It is wrong to gauge compassion by a person's willingness to spend government funds, other people's money, on aid programs. It would be like saying a person is brave because they want to spend money on defense programs. Paul said in 2 Corinthians 9:7, each of you should give what you have decided in your heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. Using force, using plunder, dependency is not true compassion. We'll close with two theologians who got it right. Lewis clearly saw the dangers of big government. Consider what he said. To live his life in his own way, to call his house his castle, to enjoy the fruits of his own labor, to educate his children as his conscience directs, to save for their prosperity after death, these are wishes deeply ingrained in civilized man. Their realization is almost as necessary to our virtues as to our happiness. From their total frustration, disastrous results, both moral and psychological, might follow. Of all the tyrannies, a tyranny exercised for the good of its victims, and that's what socialism claims to be, it may be the most oppressive. In the Screwtape Letters, Lewis describes how to turn society into hell on earth. Let no man live who is wiser or better or more famous or even handsomer than the mass. Cut them down to a level, all slaves, all ciphers, all nobodies, all equals. In other words, socialism. And then Gresham Machen, he opposed almost any extension of state power, and you can read that there. He said, place the lives of children in their formative years, despite the conviction of their parents, under the intimate control of experts appointed by the state. Force them to attend schools where the higher aspirations of humanity are crushed out and where the mind is filled with the materialism of the day. And it is difficult to see how even the remnants of liberty can subsist. So the conclusion, socialism is merely an iron fist wrapped in a velvet glove. From the outside, it may look reasonable and appealing. The state will care for you. The state will relieve you of many worries and responsibilities. The state will give you free stuff. The state will help the poor, punish the rich. But inside that velvet glove, you'll find force and compulsion. It's about political and economic power. Its promises to care for you are the bait. The state has nothing to give anybody except what it first takes from somebody else. The state is the entity that socialists and progressives seek to elevate and empower. Nothing, as you know, brings bad people forth and licenses them to do evil more than concentrated power. Power was at odds with what Jesus taught and preached. He would never endorse a scheme rooted in envy and theft. So that's socialism. And we have about 5 minutes to, is that right? 5 minutes? Something like that? Let me double check. Oh, 10 minutes to cover abortion. All right. So, a lot has happened with this topic over the last few months, as you know. We're going to approach this a little different. We're going to jump right into arguments that a pro-choice person would make and then look at the response of a pro-life person. I think that will make it go a little faster and be a little easier to understand. So basically, a pro-choice position: a mother has the right to end the life of a preborn baby for whatever reason, known as the mother's right to choose. This right came from a right to privacy as found by the Supreme Court in Roe v. Wade. The pro-choice position is based upon the assumption that the fetus is not a person. It's totally dependent upon the mother, cannot survive without her, and therefore has no inherent right to live. The pro-life position, on the other hand, is based upon the fact that a fetus is a human life with a separate DNA, has an inherent right to live, should not be terminated, even if the mother chooses not to parent her child, that child can grow and flourish with another family through adoption or foster care. From a spiritual standpoint, a preborn baby is made in the image of God, is known by God, and has a life purpose. So let's look at some of these arguments that pro-choice individuals would make. First of all, probably the most common, a woman has the right to decide what she wants to do with her body. We've heard that over and over and over again. Here's our response as Christians or as a pro-life person. We must first answer the most fundamental question in this discussion. Is a preborn baby a human life or not? Embryology holds that the preborn are human beings from fertilization. When a male sperm unites with a female oocyte, it forms a single cell called a zygote that has its own DNA, distinct from the mother's DNA. While a woman or anyone else does have the right to decide what to do with their own body, a preborn baby is not a part of the woman's body. It's a new life. No one ever asked a pregnant woman, "How's your body?" When asking about the fetus, people ask, "How's the baby?" Our society says that for a mother to end the life of a one-year-old toddler is not acceptable. Why? Because that one-year-old is a human being. By the same logic, if a preborn baby is human, how is it acceptable to end their life for the sake of a woman's right to choose? Another argument, an embryo simply isn't life. Well, it's true that human beings were less developed when they were embryos in their mother's wombs, but why does that matter? Why would size determine value? Why would the level of development be the thing that gives us rights? It doesn't. It shouldn't. Adults aren't more human or have more value than kids do. A 7-foot-tall NBA player is not more human than a 5-foot-6 person simply because they're taller. There are many living beings that are not persons that have both value and rights. Dogs and other animals, for example. A living being doesn't have to be a person to have intrinsic moral value and rights. It's interesting to consider this. Pro-choice people do, in fact, believe that a human fetus has intrinsic moral value and an absolute right to live, but only when a pregnant woman wants to give birth. If a woman doesn't want to give birth, a pro-choice person regards the fetus as worthless. You can't have it both ways. Either a human fetus has worth or it doesn't. Another argument, a decision about an abortion is a private matter between a woman and her doctor. We hear that a lot. Deciding whether to have an abortion is serious, should be made with wise counsel. But we must first answer the most fundamental question, is a preborn baby a human life or not? And of course, as we know, embryology holds that a preborn baby is a human being from fertilization. Our society says that for the mother to end the life of a one-year-old toddler is not acceptable. Why? Because that one-year-old is a human being. By the same logic, if a preborn baby is human, how is it acceptable to end the life for the same sake of a woman's right to choose? As for privacy, a woman certainly has a right to talk discreetly with her doctor, as any patient does, but having a private consultation with her doctor should not result in ending the life of another human being. It's more humane to end the life of a baby who would otherwise be born into an abusive home or one where the baby is not wanted. Well, obviously the argument there is there's adoption, there's fostering, things of that nature. This is a difficult situation. First, a caring response is to come alongside the woman and offer as much help as possible. She is facing real-life struggles that might require the help of law enforcement even, or a pregnancy resource center, maybe both. Imagine that mother had a 2-year-old. Would it be okay to end the toddler's life to spare him or her future abuse? Of course not. The mother would seek a safe space for her child or find a friend or a relative or an agency to help. A preborn child should be treated with the same love and care. As a society, we don't take the life of an innocent human being simply because someone may want to abuse them in the future, or because they are or may not be wanted. Similarly, we shouldn't end a preborn baby's life because of any possible future hardship. If abortion is okay when the mother has decided she doesn't want the baby, is any reason okay?
Would it be moral to abort a female fetus because the mother prefers boys to girls? Assuming it could be determined, would it be moral to kill a gay fetus because the mother didn't want a gay child? Of course not. If a woman can't afford to deliver and raise a baby, she has the right to end the baby's life so they're both not financially burdened. This is one of the most cold-hearted reasons I can think of. But again, as a pro-life person, we need to show compassion to someone in that situation, coming alongside them, providing resources, referrals, help. No mother would end the life of her post-born child so she could better be in a financial position. So why would it be okay to end the life of a pre-born baby for financial reasons? It's not. How did we get to the place of believing it's all right to kill your child to get ahead? Abortion is health care. We even have bills in Congress that include abortion as health care. Well, what do you mean by health care? The original Hippocratic Oath explicitly forbids abortion as a valid medical practice. The maxim, do no harm, which undergirds the oath, suggests that ending a life is antithetical to the purpose of medicine. Health care involves health. It involves wellness, not the intent to kill. My goodness. Number 7, pro-lifers would rather the mother die than have an abortion. We even hear some people say that every now and then. That's not true, of course. A baby isn't human until it's born, therefore it has no rights. Well, think about this. How do two human parents, create offspring that is not human, but later becomes human? Can you explain that? The argument that a preborn baby isn't human until it's born is claiming that location determines human value. But that's faulty. At the delivery of a baby, how does a change from inside the womb to outside the womb change the essential nature of the baby? How does a journey of 8 inches suddenly transform this baby from non-human to human? How does that baby change from non-valuable to something that is valuable just by location? Location should have no bearing on our worth. Pro-life views are anti-women. We hear that all the time. That's simply not true. I like the last statement there. Unborn women would certainly disagree that being pro-life is anti-woman. Preborn babies aren't developed enough or self-aware enough to be considered human. We've sort of covered this on previous responses. But let's look at a little bit of this. Why would the level of development be the thing that gives human beings rights? It doesn't and it shouldn't. A 4-year-old girl doesn't have the mature reproductive system and is less developed compared to a 24-year-old woman. But we don't think the 4-year-old is any less human or has any less value than the 24-year-old. Ending a person's life based on size or level of development, environment, degree of dependency is arbitrary and immoral. Abortions are safe, legal, rare. Pro-lifers exaggerate the abortion issue to make it seem worse than it is. Well, that phrase, safe, legal, and rare, came out of Bill Clinton's 1996 re-election campaign. But of course, we know that abortion is not safe because a human being dies in every abortion. Half of those are females. Second, suggesting abortions are legal does not equal that it's moral. Again, there's a lot of instances in history where things have been legal but not moral. And of course, it's not rare. Since the Roe decision in 1973, over 62.5 million unborn children have been terminated. A pro-life view is anti-science. That's not true either. Science and medicine hold that from the earliest stages of development, the preborn are distinct, living, whole human beings. Quit trying to force your religious views on me. Pro-life advocates don't have to quote the Bible or draw from a faith tradition to believe that human life has value. Abortion is a moral issue because the preborn are human beings. Is it right or wrong to end the life of a human being? Do certain circumstances dictate what is right or wrong? Those are philosophical questions that deal with reality and existence. Taking the life of another person, especially a defenseless human being like a preborn baby, is morally wrong. Limiting or prohibiting abortion is forcing your morality on me. Well, think about this. Each and every law in our country, every law in our country in some way regulates behavior. It requires citizens to follow a rule of morality. Prohibitions against theft, assault, arson, murder, they're reflective of what our society has said either is or is not moral. So should there be no laws regulating behavior if someone disagrees with that law? Of course not. Look at this. How can you support the death penalty and be pro-life? Well, this is an easy one. Pro-life means you do not kill innocent human beings. Someone who has been found guilty through a due process judicial system, they have committed a crime and they are receiving the punishment that a jury has assessed. Totally different situations. So don't be taken in by that argument at all. What about rape and incest? Of course, this is a diversionary tactic. The percentage of abortions related to these cases are extremely small. It's kind of a false flag that is thrown up every now and then. Still a very difficult issue. There's a lot of discussion there. We don't have time to unpack that tonight. Abortion is the law of the land. It's been settled law for 50 years. You can't change it. Well, really? What about Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, which overturned 1896 case Plessy versus Ferguson, which institutionalized segregation? Of course you can overturn laws that society believes were badly decided in the first place. There's a constitutional right to an abortion. No, there's not. There's nothing in the Constitution. It's just as Samuel Alito has said, rights not mentioned in the Constitution that may be guaranteed under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment must be, quote, deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition and implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. The right to an abortion doesn't fall within that category. If the federal government is not granted power or responsibility in a certain area by the Constitution, then that power or responsibility rests with the people or the states. That's what the 10th Amendment specifically states. And then this last argument. With the overturning of Roe, abortion will be illegal in the country. It's going to be the end of democracy. We've heard that. That's not true. Now it's left up to individual states. What could be more democratic than that, than to return this issue to the elected legislatures of every state rather than an unelected body of 9 people deciding the issue? Much more democratic. So that argument fails easily. Here's some additional points that a pro-life person might make. Science has advanced significantly since the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision. It would be 1988, I believe, before sonograms were available. I think if sonograms had been in use in 1973, that decision might have been the other way. Of course, science has advanced. We know when a baby can feel pain and when hearts beat, etc. What will future generations say about us? This is very confronting. In time, it is going to be impossible to deny that abortion is violence against children. Future generations, they may look upon us as the same way we look at Nazis and slave owners today. Abortion is unspeakable violence. I'm not going to describe how that occurs, but I think you can imagine. Unborn children have potential of which we're not aware. Think of all the babies that have been aborted that could have been doctors, leaders, all kinds of incredible people that might have cured cancer, who knows what. And look at this one. Abortion affects minority communities to a greater degree. The psychological toll on the mother can last a lifetime. Chris could certainly speak to that very well. And of course, biblical points. You know the scriptures, we won't go through these, but there's a number of very poignant scriptures that clearly say that an unborn baby is human and is made in the image of God. And I'm going to close with this. I hope I can get through it. This is an editorial written by Jim Ross Lightfoot. He's a retired member of the U.S. House. He served from 1985 to 1997. And his mother, when she was pregnant with him, faced the decision of whether to carry him to term or have an abortion. And so he wrote this essay called A Voice from the Womb. I frequently wonder if one of my aborted brothers or sisters may have possessed the cure for cancer, depression, diabetes, or any other serious disease without a cure. How many were engineers, artists, mechanics, musicians, or good parents? We will never know. They are gone forever. Mom, may I say something to you from here in your warm, safe womb? You have a couple of choices to return your life to what it was before I came along. It's too late for one of those choices. Choice one, you didn't make. You became pregnant. My dad has responsibility for this choice as well. Choice two, you can let me be born and then put me up for adoption. Or you can let the abortionist take my life. Either way, you are rid of me and your life may continue. One thing I do worry about is if you choose the abortion route, will you be plagued the rest of your life with a feeling of guilt for putting your interests ahead of mine by having me killed? The last thing I want to say, Mom, I had no role in the initiation of your pregnancy. I'm just an innocent child waiting to be born. Should you choose the abortionist over me, you are taking the life of the one person that genuinely loves you. You have kept me safe in your womb. You have allowed me to grow. Why do you want to take my innocent life? One of the things as Christians that we have assurance of is forgiveness. And I think the statistics show that 1 in 4 American women have had an abortion. And the good thing about the gospel is that the blood of Christ covers all shortcomings, including abortion.